So today I have joining me Dr. Ronald Pies. Dr. Pies, thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome and thanks for inviting me, Daniel.
Yeah, it's a pleasure and an honor. If you wouldn't mind, sir, could you go ahead and kind of introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. I'm a psychiatric physician. I'm a professor emeritus of psychiatry at State University of New York, Upstate Medical Center in Syracuse, and a clinical professor. Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry at Tufts University School of Medicine, and formerly the editor-in-chief of Psychiatric Times. I have some other monikers, but I'll stop there.
No, that's yeah, good, nice, thorough, yet short introduction. I found you actually. I've been hearing about. I started hearing about Thomas Schatz and hearing about different perspectives on that. It seems to be cropping up a lot lately, at least in my little online circle for whatever reason. And I found your name. And you have a history with Dr. Thomas Schatz, don't you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
Yes, I
can you tell
do.
us a little bit about that?
Sure. When I was a resident back in the Paleolithic era at Upstate Medical Center, this would have been roughly 1979 to 1982. Dr. Sass was one of our faculty members. And really, although it's ironic to say this, really a teacher of mine. And we had some very, very interesting and sometimes contentious discussions and debates. So I'll leave it at that.
Sauce, that's how you pronounce
Having a little trouble hearing you.
Ah, my bad. Is you said sauce, right? Is that how you pronounced it?
He pronounced it sass, like
Sauce.
SASS, but most
Okay.
people pronounced it as Zaz.
Ah, okay. What you said you were a resident at that time?
I was a resident, yes.
And did your professional communications with him continue past residency?
Oh, yes, it did. And there were a couple of books out about sass. To which I contributed chapters, the most recent of which was edited. It is called Thomas Sass, An Appraisal of His Legacy. It's edited by one of my other teachers, Dr. Haldapour, and a colleague of mine, James Knoll, and Eric Luft, Luft. So Thomas Sass, An Appraisal of His Legacy. I had a chapter in that book. And that was just recently within the last few years. Dr. Sass died, I believe, in 2012 or somewhere in that area. But we had kept up communications so over the years, sporadically.
During residency, what is it that I guess where did your so you already I guess had a pretty solidified view of psychiatry and the way that you deal with mental illness in order to have contentious conversations with Dr. Sauce that early on?
Well, I'm not sure I had completely settled all my views about psychiatry, but I certainly did not agree with his view that mental illness is a myth. And of course, his famous book, I think it was 1961, was titled The Myth of Mental Illness. And essentially, to summarize very inadequately, Zaz believed that the term mental illness did not refer to any real kind of illness. He viewed the term mental illness as kind of a metaphor, or he saw, quote, mental illness as metaphorical disease and not real disease. I mean, I'm summarizing 50 years of his work very inadequately, but I think anyone who had gone into psychiatry at that point would have been dubious about that claim. So Even without fully settled views on the matter, I felt it was reasonable to offer a counter view to that of Saas.
I don't think we really planned it, but you getting on that topic, I could see maybe the contention of saying mental disease, from what I know of his view on what how you define disease. And I guess I can understand the point of mental illness being more metaphorical. I've heard, mental is not a, mentality cannot be ill. But when it comes to, I know not to, I know you've quibbled a lot over the years with various people on the definition of disease. I do like your definition. Can you tell us your definition and maybe why you had that contention that you do?
Sure, very briefly. I mean, Zaz's contention was that the only kind of real disease, or the only disease that we ought to recognize as real, is a condition in which we can identify a lesion, pathology, in other words, tissue pathology, or excuse me, or some very clear pathophysiology that we can point to. So, if you can show that somebody has a defect in their prefrontal cortex, or you can show that they have a problem metabolizing protein or something like that, then and only then can you say that this person has a disease. Now, that's what I would call a positivist sort of view of disease. Positivism. Going back to the Vienna Circle in the 1930s, and people like Carnap and others. My own view, and I think the view of most physicians, and I would argue even most philosophers of science, would say that Zaz's view of disease is an extremely narrow one, and perhaps one that doesn't really fit the history of medicine. Just to give you an example, when James Parkinson identified Parkinson's disease in the 19th century, although he didn't call it that, nobody had a clue as to what was causing it, what the pathophysiology was, or anything really other than its manifest symptoms and signs. And it wasn't until really early 20th century that people began to understand what exactly Parkinson had found, which eventually, gained his name. And yet it would be absurd to say that Parkinson's disease didn't exist until, the 1960s. So there was no identifiable lesion. There was no abnormality, physiological abnormality. It was just a series of signs and symptoms that coalesced very reliably and was applicable to hundreds or thousands of other patients. And that's really how we identify disease in the first place. First, we identify some degree of suffering or incapacity. Then we find the sort of syndromal content of the condition, in other words, the collection of signs and symptoms that cohere. And then we begin to look for things like family history, genetics, and very late in the game, we begin to find the biology or the neurobiology of these conditions, maybe. And there are still conditions that we call disease these days, like, for example, idiopathic facial pain or even migraine, where we still don't fully understand the physiology of these conditions, but they're widely recognized as disease states. So that's very, very briefly where Zaz and I differed, and where I think Zaz differs with most philosophers of medicine and philosophers of science today.
Thank you for that summary. Disease, I know I've seen some of your writings where you say it's dis-ease and yeah, suffering and incapacity. I assume that like the underlying contention that someone like Zaz had, or some of these other proponents of this type of thinking, is that maybe earlier on, disease was something that people thought of as medical, and maybe even like a migraine. If you have a migraine, maybe you see your medical doctor. But some of these other things like depression, that they're less likely to see as being medical, and maybe it shouldn't be medical doctors that treat it or treat it according to a medical model. Is that kind of the underlying concern? Is once we start calling disease anything that is suffering and incapacity, then that disease is now treated medically, and that's the concern.
Well, I think it's complicated, Daniel. I would start by saying, first of all, when I say that suffering and incapacity are hallmarks of disease, I don't claim that every kind of suffering and incapacity is disease. I mean, for example, if you're kidnapped and tied to a chair and tortured by terrorists, you'll be suffering and you'll be incapacitated, but we don't say that you have a disease. So disease is a specific kind of suffering and incapacity, in my view, whereby we can identify characteristic signs and symptoms, and whereby we can find evidence of external validators, such as family history, sometimes genetic patterns, and eventually, we sometimes find pathophysiology. Now, the issue of the medical model is a complicated one. I think people have a misunderstanding of what the medical model is. Commonly, it's misunderstood as nothing more than biology. I think that's a very narrow view of the medical model. I mean, in fact, the medical model really is the biopsychosocial model that George Engel described way back in the 1960s, or actually the 1970s. And when I talk about the medical model, I always have in mind that people are coming to us with various forms of suffering and incapacity that have biological, psychological, and social, and sometimes cultural and spiritual roots to them. So the medical model doesn't narrowly define disease in terms of biology. Now, who gets to see the patient? That's another issue. That's another question. Whether you see a neurologist or a psychiatrist or an internist. And that has to do more with how services are divvied up among the various medical specialties.
And I guess that's the thing about the George Engel and the biopsychosocial model. I know he wrote I'm trying to, I don't remember the reference. I know it was in the 1977, but he wrote the dominant model of disease today is biomedical, and it leaves no room within its framework for the social, psychological, and behavioral dimensions of illness.
Yes.
And yeah, so he was talking about broadening the scope, and by using the biopsychosocial model, we need to take into account all of these factors. But also, once medical doctors start taking into all those factors all into account, does that then also mean that they have more of a purview? Does that make sense?
More of a purview than.
If medical doctors, let's say that their predominant mode of treatment was for disease and disease was biomedical, but they and the you know one of the plus sides of thinking biopsychosocial is if someone has something like diabetes and they're trying to treat this disease medically, well, they can also take into account the social factors and the psychological factors, and maybe they can refer them to see a therapist that might be able to help them with the psychological factors. So that's like the positive of taking these other factors into account and not drilling it all the way down to a biomedical approach. But
Yes.
once medical doctors begin seeing disease in the biopsychosocial sense or lens, then does that also open them up to treating more things that fall outside of the medical scope?
Well, in theory, it could. I mean, a good internist is applying the biopsychosocial model. Or ought to be, internists, internal medicine specialists recognize that, when their patient comes to them with diabetes or obesity or any number of other conditions, there are usually psychosocial factors that are involved. Why is the person obese? Well, they eat when they're under stress. Why does the person's glucose control vary depending on their mood state or their compliance with medication? All of these things, a good internist will take all of those things into account. And I would add, so would a good psychiatrist. That's why I view psychiatry as, a medical specialty, but medical in the very broad sense of looking at all of these factors. Biopsychosocial, and I would add, and this is more of a personal view of it, also add spiritual concerns because people do have spiritual concerns. And one of my teachers in residency, Bob Daly, who passed away just a few years ago, used to say the great thing about psychiatry is that you can do biology in the morning and theology in the afternoon. And he used to say that tongue in cheek, but I think it's really true of the field as a whole. It's a very broad field, and there's room for all of those aspects of medical care. And that's what I would mean by the quote medical model.
That makes sense. I like that. I think I guess your thoughts on when I think of the medical model of treating mental illness, I think more of we're going to boil this down to this is the disease that you have, and there is a cure for this disease. Let's say it's a psychiatric medication. Or there is something that we have that we can offer you, to treat your disease. Maybe it's not a cure, maybe it's a treatment, maybe it helps, but it doesn't take away the underlying root cause or the etiology. So I guess from that narrow definition, that's a speak thinking like medically treating psychological or mental disorders. I know you wrote an article in Psychiatric Times. I think it was called The Art of Non-Prescribing.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I like that. And I was reading through that, and I thought that had some pretty good guidelines and ways of thinking. And there was another, I forget the other article, but it was talking about a hypothetical patient who walked into your office and was feeling down for the past 3 weeks following, I think it was following a divorce. And you said that most people, it was like, oh yeah, a month ago, his fiance left him for another man and he feels there's no point in going on. He hasn't been sleeping well, his appetite is poor, and he has lost interest in nearly all of his usual activities. Most people would, and then you said, until solid research persuades me otherwise, I will most likely see people like my jilted patient as clinically depressed, not just normally sad, and I will provide him with whatever psychiatric treatment he needs to feel better.
Oh, I think you're quoting from a New York Times piece that I did.
Oh, okay. There we go. Sorry, I didn't have the reference for that one.
It's okay.
I've done a lot of reading over the past couple months.
Yes, I appreciate that, by the way.
So I guess I'm thinking if you have like a medical lens for treating someone like him with, let's say, clinical depression following a divorce and all of these catastrophes, and I don't know exactly what you mean there by you said that you would treat him with however psychiatrically, what to ever help to make him feel better. Would you advise or recommend or encourage psychiatric medication for somebody in that condition, situation?
Yeah, that's a very good question. That article was written, I think that was one of my early entries into the debate over the bereavement exclusion, which is a very complicated debate. It had to do with whether someone who has recently lost a loved one and presents with signs and symptoms of clinical depression within, let's say, the first few weeks. Really has clinical depression, or is this sort of normal grief? And how do you treat it? That's a complicated debate. I've got lots and lots of papers on that. You may have seen some of them. Ultimately, the DSM-5 dropped the bereavement exclusion for what I thought were good and sufficient reasons. But to get back to the case that you outlined, I left it very vague about using whatever treatment helps the patient deliberately because it's always a judgment call as to whether the person merits so-called talk therapy alone, or talk therapy, psychotherapy, plus a medication when they present with the signs and symptoms of a major depression. And I don't think there's one answer to that. A lot depends on how incapacitated the person is, how much, what the degree of suffering is. It depends in part on whether the person is amenable to talk therapy or amenable to medication. All of these are, issues to work out with the particular patient. What I will say is that in my own practice, for most cases of mild to moderate depression, and I'm now talking about clinical depression, not ordinary grief at all, for most cases of mild to moderate major depression, I usually recommend starting with psychotherapy, talk therapy, whether it's supportive or psychodynamic or whatever, and see if that works. If the person deteriorates or doesn't get better, then I think medication is a consideration. But I prefer to begin with talk therapy whenever feasible. Now, for patients with very severe depressive syndromes or psychotic depression, where they're actually delusional, the evidence is pretty good that psychotherapy alone is not going to be effective, that medication is necessary. So I think the answer to your question is it depends on a lot of different factors. There's no, cookie cutter, response to, how to treat a depressed patient. A lot of it depends on the particular signs and symptoms and the patient's preferences.
Let's say even for either of those kind of you mentioned if it's maybe mild to moderate clinical depression, maybe starting off with talk therapy. If it's the severely depression, maybe a combination. Do you have a view on, let's just stick with major depressive disorder for a
Okay.
moment. Do you have a view on the long-term use of antidepressants?
That's a very good question. And, the fact is we don't have great studies that compare long-term treatment, meaning, let's say, greater than, I would define that as 2 years or greater. We don't have a lot of gold standard studies looking at medication versus no medication. Or medication versus placebo, medication versus psychotherapy. We don't have a lot of gold standard studies looking at treatment past about 2 years or so. And I think, once again, it depends on the patient. somebody who has had four major depressive episodes that resulted in, suicide attempts and hospitalization, and has relapsed after attempts to discontinue the antidepressant, is probably a person that I am going to want to maintain on antidepressants, probably indefinitely. And there are risks in doing that for sure, risks that we can discuss if you want to. That's an extreme example. On the other hand, somebody who has had one episode of major depression, you treat them with, let's say, a combination of supportive therapy and antidepressant. They recover more or less completely from that episode, and they're stable for, let's say, a year. That's a person I would think very seriously about tapering off their antidepressant, seeing how they do. One of the myths about psychiatry, I think, is that we just love to keep people on medication for as long as we can. I don't know anybody in the field who really feels that way. I mean, if we can get away without using medication, we're going to do that. I mean, we recognize that, this is not candy that we're handing out. These are medications which, like all medications, whether you're talking about cancer chemotherapy or, antibiotics, they have their risks and their benefits. Now, if we can get away without keeping a person on an antidepressant indefinitely, that's the course that, most of my colleagues would choose, if at all possible. But again, it depends on sort of a very fine-tuned risk-benefit calculation for that particular patient. I don't know if that helps answer your question.
Yeah, no, I think that's helpful. I think, and I know that this is all very nuanced, and I know that this would preferably be written down and discussed carefully. So just throwing that out there. When it comes to, I think maybe a gray area, like one of the in reading maybe some of the people who are more, whether you want to call them like critical of psychiatry or anti-psychiatry, I think, like, let's say that you have a client who is on maybe the more moderate to severe end of depression and have been treated with antidepressants for the past 5 years and have even tried different, like maybe four or five, six different, SSRIs, antidepressants, and there's not been a whole lot of gains or symptom remission. I think the like someone like that, would if they came to you, would you look at them and think whatever we're doing is not working, or would you think, well, maybe we just haven't tried the right antidepressant yet, or we need to keep, like, if we take them, then there's also the if you try to take them off, but they have like the discontinuation syndrome, or and so we need to put them back on. I don't know. That's the confusing part for me. Does that make sense? I wasn't very articulate.
No, I think you're raising a good question. I mean, in part, I think you're talking about what usually is called treatment-resistant depression, or TRD. I mean, in the case that you described, somebody has been on, I think you said, four or five different antidepressants, and it hasn't had much effect. Is that sort of the what you're setting up? That is really the bread and butter of psychiatry. In the sense that it's our job to figure out why is this person's depression so treatment resistant. That's the first and most basic question to ask. And there are many, many possible causes for that. They could have an underlying endocrine problem. They could have a personality disorder that is obscuring the benefits, if any, of the medication. Sometimes borderline personality disorder patients, for example, get put on medication after medication, and lo and behold, they're not better. Well, what a surprise.
Yeah.
their showing the effects of their personality disorder. Or sometimes the person has poor compliance with their medication. They're not taking it the way it's directed, or they're not absorbing it, or they're metabolizing it too quickly. In my experience, one of the most common reasons why people have so-called treatment-resistant depression is that they've been misdiagnosed. And these patients often turn out to be bipolar disorder patients who are sometimes made worse by antidepressants. And I think that was one of the questions that you sent me in your list of questions. Talked about someone switching from unipolar depression to bipolar after taking an SSRI. Well, that was one reason that my colleague, Dr. Nasir Ghami, and I developed the bipolar spectrum diagnostic scale, the BSDS, to find these cases of covert bipolar depression. When you put these folks on a mood stabilizer like lithium, for example, they often do remarkably well, and they can often do poorly or even get worse on an antidepressant. So those are all the kinds of questions that psychiatrists grapple with when they see a patient with so-called treatment-resistant depression. I'm not sure that gets at what you're asking, but
That's helpful. And I guess going off of that is, have you, so I've, if you've ever read, have you read any of Peter Bragan's books or Robert Whittaker's, like The Anatomy of an Epidemic? Have you read the books?
I'm very familiar with Robert Whittaker's work, and have actually written a bunch of articles about his work, critical articles, as you might expect. And I'd be happy to send you those. I have not read. You mentioned Peter Bragan. I have not read his book. I know he has a book out, something like Toxic Psychiatry or something like that. I'm familiar with his views more generally against the use of medication. And while I don't want to get into personalities or particular people, I'm happy to discuss any of the substantive claims that either person might make.
Okay, so I think that the way that people like Dr. Peter Bragan or Robert Whittaker are framing the argument is that people get put on psychiatric medication when maybe that's not the answer in the first place. And then there are these people who are on, let's say, SSRIs for years and years and years, and then they slowly taper off the medication. Maybe Dr. Peter Bragan seems to try and say that the more locus of control you put onto the patient, instead of saying here's some external factor that we can offer that's going to help you, it's more, I don't know, maybe the wrong way to frame this, but and it's simplifying the argument maybe, but maybe putting that locus of control back on the patient, pick yourself up by your bootstraps type of thing. What look around at your life, what needs to be solved that medication isn't going to solve for you. And then you taper off the medication, and then these people get better. And they have like case examples of someone who was on antidepressants, let's say, for 5, 10 years, and then was never, fully living a prosperous, successful life, what however you want to say that. And then they taper off the medication and things get better and they have a whole new outlook on life. So that's the way that I think they kind of frame it sometimes. And just wanted to get your thoughts. Are they just cherry picking? Is that maybe people who are on the wrong medication in the first place? Is there any type of substance in that view of something like a medication is taking what is perhaps a psychological problem and saying that here's your answer, or here's, reach out to some external resource for you.
Well, those are good questions. First of all, I guess I would want to separate Whitaker's views from some of the ones that you've attributed to Peter Bregg. And, I don't, from what I know of Whitaker, he is not actually opposed to using psychiatric medications. I think he has doubts as to how effective they are, and that's a that's a reasonable discussion and a debate. And you mentioned in your questions to me some of Irving Kirsch's work.
Oh,
There's
yeah.
lots of debates about how effective are, for example, antidepressants. But I think the question you're raising about locus of control is really the main issue that I think we need to address. I think it's a mistake to imagine that psychiatrists believe either that A, medication is the whole answer to the patient's problems, or B, that psychiatry neglects the element of internal work that needs to take place in almost any kind of psychotherapeutic encounter. I mean, psychiatrists, it is true, if you look at practice patterns, psychiatrists have been nudged over into a kind of prescribing mode, and that's an unfortunate effect of market forces. No one wants to pay a psychiatrist to do psychotherapy when you can have a social worker do it at a much lower price. But the core value of psychiatry is that there's no incompatibility between medication and doing the internal work that's necessary for people to make important changes in their life. That's why, I would never recommend for any patient that they, quote, just take a pill. I mean, that's such a reductionistic and really inaccurate way of looking at psychiatry, in my view. And I recognize that, psychiatrists in many treatment settings have been relegated to the role of, writing out a prescription for a patient in a 15-minute session, and the psychotherapy gets done, if at all, by, someone who doesn't earn the same kind of wages that the psychiatrist would earn. But that's certainly not the model that most psychiatrists would adopt. I always used to use the expression or the analogy of the bridge with patients, and I would say, look, medication is a bridge between feeling awful and feeling better, but you still have to walk across that bridge. And then the patient would always say, well, what do you mean, doc? What do you mean I have to walk across the bridge? And I would say, well, there are things in your life that may be contributing to why you're depressed, whether it's your marriage or your social isolation, or maybe some of the ways that you view things. And then I would get into issues of cognitive therapy, for example, rational emotive behavioral therapy, which you're probably familiar with Albert Ellis's work. So if medication is a bridge between feeling awful and feeling better, and the patient still has to walk across that bridge, there's plenty of room for locus of control. And I think the dichotomy that some critics of psychiatry want to create is really a false choice. And I think it's a destructive false choice. It makes patients feel guilty about taking medication. The last thing somebody needs when they're depressed is feeling more guilty or feeling like they're weak because they're taking a medication. I once wrote a piece talking about the Puritan heritage in this country. And I think that, Puritan was once defined as someone who has the morbid fear that someone somewhere is enjoying themselves. And I think there's a kind of a puritanical view about medication that critics of psychiatry, particularly anti-psychiatry people, have. That if you take medication, you're ignoring the underlying problems, or you're running away from them, or you're giving up any kind of self-governance in your life. I think all of that is a lot of baloney, and I think it's destructive baloney because it makes patients feel guilty. There's no contradiction between doing the internal work of therapy and taking a medication. Now, that's a different issue from how effective antidepressants are, what the risks of long-term treatment are. Psychiatrists are very, very aware of these issues that are, worthy of debate. So that's a long answer to your question.
No, that's helpful. Yeah, I guess the next question with the, let's say, with Dr. Irving Kirsch and his kind of argument being that a lot of the effectiveness of antidepressants are actually placebo. If it comes to the bridge analogy, like you mentioned, I wonder if the bridge is really somewhat of an illusion, and by choosing to walk across the bridge rather than to swim, you might end up walking with a limp or with some other type of thing that makes life a little bit more difficult due to the negative side effects that antidepressants might bring. Does that make sense?
Well, yes, it makes sense that you're sort of extending the metaphor and giving it a little tweak, which is fine. Let's first of all talk a little bit about placebo because I think this is a really misunderstood notion. People have the idea that antidepressant studies simply test a sugar pill, quote unquote, against an active medication. Well, that's not how studies work. That's not how they're set up. And rather than talking about the placebo effect, we should be talking about the placebo condition. When these studies are done, the patients in the so-called placebo group are actually getting quite a bit of attention from staff. They're getting hours of what I would call supportive meetings with professionals, mental health professionals. And so they're not simply being given a sugar pill. So we're talking about the placebo condition, which involves essentially supportive intervention versus supportive intervention plus, a medication. So that's one point. The second point is that, Kirsch's work is based primarily, as is most research in depression, based on the use of the Hamilton Depression Scale, which you're probably familiar with. And, there are two versions, two main versions of the Hamilton Scale, 17 items and 21 items. Now, what Kirsch finds basically, and I have not done a systematic review of his most recent work, I can tell you that it's quite controversial. There have been many psychiatrists who have rebutted his work, but just with that proviso, the Hamilton scale is one way of looking at the efficacy of antidepressants. My own view is that what you're actually measuring is the effect of the antidepressant on the Hamilton scale. There's a Buddhist expression, and I think you may have come across it in some of my other articles, a finger pointing at the moon is not the moon. The Hamilton scale is kind of a finger pointing at depression, but it's not the depression itself, and it's not the patient. So what you're really looking at when you look at, all these meta-analyses of placebo versus antidepressant and the Hamilton scale, you're really looking at how the Hamilton scale changes as the patient is treated in these various ways. Now, one problem is that there are different ways you can group the items on the Hamilton scale. So, for example, Beck, BECH, has looked at something called the HAM-D6. And those are focusing, that focuses on six items measuring severity of clinical depression, depressed mood, guilt, work and interest, tiredness, anxiety, and psychomotor retardation. And for the second generation antidepressants in placebo-controlled studies, if you use the HAM-D6, you get an effect size of 0.4 or greater in comparison with placebo, which is quite a robust response to antidepressants. Now, that's a lot of detail to throw at you. The bottom line and the take-home point is don't believe everything you read about the Hamilton scale and the efficacy of antidepressants. It depends really on how you score it and what items you look at. And more importantly, and this is something I've written a few papers on, is quality of life. There are not enough studies of QOL, quality of life, and antidepressant response. When you look at the existing studies of quality of life, and they're not perfect studies by any means, but based on the evidence we have, it seems clear, at least I find it quite clear, that quality of life measured on very in various ways improves for most patients who are diagnosed accurately with unipolar major depression and who are given an antidepressant. And quality of life, in my view, it may be in a more important and more accurate way of looking at the effect of these drugs. So that's a kind of a response to the issue of Kirsch. There are other studies we can discuss. You know, there's a major study by Stone and colleagues that was, I think, widely misinterpreted in the general press. But I'll just close my response by saying, Daniel, there are very few psychiatrists who think that antidepressants are some kind of a magical cure for depression. We recognize that these are imperfect agents. They have potentially serious side effects, like all effective medications throughout the house of medicine. You have to be very careful, very conservative, and we try to use them only when we're really up against the wall and we have to use them. And you were raising the issue of, the sort of the limping, or that the antidepressant is somehow going to cause long-term harms in the patient, and I'm not sure what you have in mind exactly, but I think that there's not very good evidence that long-term antidepressant medication causes any kind of serious harm for patients, but there can be substantial side effects. That is true. Sexual side effects, which can be disturbing. Weight gain in some cases. And we're talking primarily about the serotonergic antidepressants. Very few people talk about bupropion, which is not serotonergic and has far fewer side effects in comparison with the SSRIs. And then there's the issue of withdrawal side effects, which I think you raised in one of your questions. That I think it has been a much overblown concern by a number of people writing in this area. I think they're mostly people who don't know how to prescribe and monitor antidepressants. That's just my personal little jibe. Not to diminish the fact that some patients have very serious withdrawal symptoms when they are suddenly taken off these antidepressants, discontinue it suddenly or cold turkey, or even at too rapid a rate. And I think that many cases, and by the way, most antidepressants are not prescribed by psychiatrists, as you may know. They're prescribed by GPs, family doctors, pediatricians. There are a lot of people prescribing them who don't know, pardon my expression, what the heck they're doing with these medications. And that is a real problem. If you taper slowly over a period of months, not weeks, period of months for people who have been on antidepressants for a long period of time, let's say longer than a year, you find actually very few serious withdrawal reactions to these medications. So if that's what you had in mind, I think that that's an issue that has been really exaggerated in the lay press and misunderstood by people who really don't have a lot of training in psychopharmacology.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. I don't know if you someone I used to watch, I don't really watch a whole lot of him anymore, but you've probably heard of Jordan Peterson somewhere along the line. He was taking benzodiazepines And he's a clinical psychologist and he seems to be well read. And he ended up going through severe withdrawals. I don't know if he stopped abruptly on his own or what happened there, but it almost killed him. I think that in the general public, a lot of people are going to just quit taking their psychiatric medication when, like you said, it should be done over months or even a year, depending on how many they're on and what they're taking.
Sure.
But do you think with that problem of a lot of people are prescribing and maybe they don't know what the heck they're doing and maybe they're not being as conservative as they need to be doing, do you think that prescribing medication, psychiatric medication, should be more to the psychiatrist and we should get rid of that prescribing privileges and primary care, nurse practitioners, I think you said GPAs, or do you think there's a different solution to that? They just need better education or training or
Yeah, those are good questions. And you did raise the issue of physician assistance in your notes to me. And do I think PAs, physician assistants, should have prescription privileges? And my short answer to that is yes, they should. But I think that they ought to be working in consultation with a psychiatrist. In contrast to nurse practitioners, for example, who can practice independently with full practice authority in at least 26 states, although I think it's really helpful for even for nurse practitioners to have a consultant, a psychiatric consultant. I think the answer to poor practice in prescribing these medications is really education. And primary care docs, PCPs, they have a really hard job. And I have a lot of respect for family practitioners and PCPs, but they will tell you themselves they have not been adequately trained to prescribe and monitor these medications. And it's very hard in many settings to get a patient's psychiatric appointment. There's a maldistribution of psychiatrists in the country. I think, I can count psychiatrists practically door by door in my neighborhood, but, out in rural Idaho, that's not the case. So PCPs are left on their often on their own to manage these medications. Sometimes we don't communicate well enough with them. Psychiatrists bear some responsibility for that. I think outreach and education is the way to deal with that. Now, just to comment on your, Jordan Peterson, I'm somewhat familiar with some of his work, but not I don't know his work well. I'll just say that benzodiazepines are another kettle of fish, so to speak. And so medications like diazepam, Valium, or clonazepam, Klonopin, and similar medications, they really can be nasty if you suddenly stop them and go cold turkey. You can have the patient can have seizures, for example. So you never want to do that. And whether the patient, whether in his case he stopped it cold turkey or prematurely, I don't know, or whether he was getting inadequate guidance from the prescriber. I really don't know, but benzodiazepines for people who are taking them long term, they too need to be tapered very, very, very slowly. I mean, often over a period of certainly many weeks, if not in some cases months. If you do it carefully and you check in with the patient week by week and ask how you're doing, you can do it and get them off it, but it's not easy. And by the way, I mean, in terms of overprescribing, I happen to believe that antipsychotic medications really are overprescribed. They're used for all kinds of things they shouldn't be used for, like anxiety, for example, or bad behavior in nursing homes or in child psychiatric wards. I mean, there's a lot of bad practice going on, and I would be the first. As a psychopharmacology consultant for 25 or so years, I saw a lot of both the best and the worst practices. And when I would consult to nursing homes and see patients on five different psychotropics, my first step was trying to get them to dis trying to get the clinician to discontinue, maybe two or three or four of those psychotropic medications. So, I guess, my message is, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, I lost the visual signal there for a second. My message is that the more training the clinician has in psychopharmacology, the more conservative that clinician is going to be, and the more careful that clinician is going to be in terms of the risk-benefit ratio for any given patient with any given medication.
Okay. I want to be respectful of your time. Can I have two more questions?
Sure.
Okay. A lot of the concerns I've heard from people are about informed consent, and I like what you're saying about the more education you have, the more conservative you are going to be in your prescribing practices.
Yes.
When it comes to informed consent and someone giving proper informed consent to their patient that they're about to start on a new medication, let's just stick with the antidepressants.
Sure.
How much of that would be something like, a lot of these studies are done on single med, like the a lot of the evidence base that we have, the studies were done on one medication, not two, three, or four different.
Yes. True.
And a lot of the studies were, they don't really examine past 12 weeks. We do have a couple of longer studies. But like how much, when it comes to informed consent, how much do you need to go in about side effects and withdrawals and the type of evidence that we have for them?
Right. Well, you asked me that question with respect to antidepressants in the series of questions you sent me, and
Yeah.
I'll answer narrowly with respect to antidepressants, if that's okay,
Okay.
since that's probably the most
Yeah.
commonly prescribed agent in outpatient psychiatry these days. Well, I personally, and I was a psychopharmacology consultant for 20 or more years, and had my own, private practice where I would treat patients. I believe that informed consent, first of all, should not be a form that the patient signs and that's it. And oh, well, now I've got informed consent. I kind of covered myself legally. That's not informed consent. That's just trying to, well, I won't use the expression, but covering oneself
Yeah.
legally. And that's not informed consent. Informed consent is a process, and it's an ongoing process where periodically you revisit the issue of how are you doing? How are you having, side effects? Well, let's talk about those and so on. So with respect to antidepressants, I believe informed consent normally should include the most common side effects and those very rare side effects that could be life-threatening. And those are very rare. I think that the physician's experience is also an important factor in what we tell patients. So, often I would say to the patient, this particular medication, this particular antidepressant, is known to produce a number of common side effects based on the studies that have been done using it as a single agent. But in my experience, it's very well tolerated for most patients. And in my experience, even if you're having side effects, we can adjust the dose and do other maneuvers that will mitigate, if not eliminate, those side effects. I also think that you need to gear your informed consent to what the patient wants to hear and is prepared to hear. I'll give you an example outside of psychiatry. I have a family member who has a form of cancer, and often we'll sit with an oncologist who wants to go over all 650 possible side effects to the cancer chemotherapy agent. This particular family member sort of stops them right there and says, "Listen, I don't want to hear all 650 possible side effects. I just get more anxious doing that. Why don't you tell me, in your experience, what are the most common side effects, and what are side effects that I have to really worry about and call you if I get them?" And there are patients who want that kind of level of informed consent. And then there are a few who say, "Listen, doc, I want to know all 650 possible side effects. I want it printed out. I want to see, but those patients are very, very rare in my experience. I mean, maybe 1 in 100. Most patients, if you have a good therapeutic alliance with that patient, will trust what you have experienced as a psychiatrist and will want informed consent on that basis. Now, specifically with the serotonergic agents, I do think that the risk of sexual dysfunction should be discussed with the patient. And some would argue that, there are rare cases of continued sexual dysfunction even after stopping the antidepressant. I think that those are very rare, but I think it should be mentioned to the patient. I think the risk of withdrawal effects should be discussed with the patient, even though, as I said, the risk of serious withdrawal effects is actually quite uncommon, despite what you may read, despite some of the British studies that have looked at that. And I'll just mention one recent study by Hensler and colleagues that found that only about 15% of patients discontinuing an antidepressant will experience withdrawal symptoms, and only about 3% will experience severe discontinuation symptoms. And I can send you that source if you want to see it. So, again, informed consent is an ongoing process. It's not a one-off sort of discussion with the patient. And you need to gear it to what the patient is really wanting to hear and is prepared to hear, based on also your own experience as an expert in prescribing these medications. I hope that's a helpful answer.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you. Okay, last question. I got like the 9 minute warning here. I don't think this one's on the list. I'm not trying to surprise you. I just want
Okay.
to when
I
it
do
comes
request.
okay. When it comes to I don't again, there seems to be within psychiatry, psychology, the mental health professions, you've got this anti-psychiatry group popping up. You've got different people, yeah, critical psychiatry. It seems, I don't know, there seems to be a pattern. You might know more about this than I do, but people in the psychiatrists and psychologists in England, they seem to have a little bit more of a anti-medication
Yes,
bias.
I think you're right.
Is this I could think more about this too, but is this unique to the mental health side of things? Are there other such professions that have such a split, or that people even train, like, you've got psychiatrists who are talking against psychiatry now, like
Yes,
so yeah, is that
unfortunately true.
Is that unique to our field or?
Yeah, that's a good question. I often see people saying that psychiatry is the only medical specialty that has an anti set up for it. You don't generally see, anti oncology writing. You don't generally see, "I'm anti-orthopedics." I'm anti-pediatrics. So on one level, you could say that psychiatry is unique in having these kinds of very vociferous, and I think sometimes misguided critics. That's what I would call, the anti-psychiatrist. Critical psychiatry is another issue, and I think that there are valuable voices within a so-called critical psychiatry movement, though I don't draw a bright line between some of them and anti-psychiatry. I think that they kind of meld at one point. On the other hand, you do get criticism. For example, rheumatologists and related medical specialists have been criticized for not recognizing, for example, chronic disease syndrome, or recognizing the long-term effects of Lyme disease. And there are isolated critiques of these specialties from time to time, that they have written them off as hysteria, or attributed some of these complaints, like chronic fatigue syndrome, to I think really sort of sexist critiques that these are, mostly women who have these kind of neurotic symptoms, and there have been criticisms in those specialties, but I think it's fair to say that psychiatry has been singled out, and there are a lot of reasons that we could go into if we had more time for that. And I will say that, psychiatry has done some things that have not been helpful over the years that have created some of this mistrust. So that's a discussion maybe for another time. And I don't think that psychiatry gets off scot-free in some of these criticisms. But this is a real problem, and I think that there is stigma not only toward mental illness and toward patients who have mental illnesses, but stigma toward psychiatrists. There are psychiatrists who get threats all the time, mainly because they're doing their jobs. So that's another issue, and one that I think again merits a lot of outreach and education. I think the more education the public has about psychiatry, the less suspicion and animosity there will be. So I'll stop there, and I know we're almost out of time.
Well, I appreciate the conversation, Dr. Pies. Thanks for making the time and battling the technology to join me.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Daniel, and I appreciate your hanging in there with all these little technical glitches.